Welcome. My name is Dr. Arthur Kim. I'm Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. This is an IAS USA module on acute hepatitis C infection. Today, I will be covering the following key topics related to acute hepatitis C infection. I'll begin by talking about the rationale to identify acute hepatitis C. I will talk about definitions of acute hepatitis C and how to diagnose this condition, as well as finally end with a module on treatment of acute hepatitis C. On this slide, I will present a case. A 22-year-old white female is seen in the clinic with a complaint of a 2-centimeter abscess within the antecubital fossa of her left arm. Upon further questioning, you learn that she has a 5-year history of injection drug use, but she is very adamant that she has never shared needles or syringes. She was tested for hepatitis C approximately 3 years ago and was seronegative at that time. Her only symptom at present is fatigue and mild discomfort at the site of the small abscess. The remainder of her exam is normal. The patient has recently shared cottons or cookers with her new boyfriend, who is of uncertain status for hepatitis C. When tested, her hepatitis B surface antigen was non-reactive. Her anti-hepatitis B core antibodies were also non-reactive, while her anti-hepatitis B surface antibody is reactive. Hepatitis A testing for antibodies are non-reactive, and her HIV is non-reactive. Her hepatitis C antibody is reactive. Her hepatitis C RNA is 3,300 international units per ml, and she tests genotype 1A. Her ALT is elevated at 120 and her AST at 90. So, looking at the parameters in isolation, is this chronic hepatitis C or is this acute hepatitis C? We'll return to this case. Firstly, I'd just like to describe the rationale to identify acute hepatitis C. There are many personal and public health benefits to identification of persons in this phase of hepatitis C infection. Firstly, one can provide education, particularly regarding how this virus is transmitted. One can also provide hepatitis A and hepatitis B vaccines to prevent additional insults to the liver. It is important for these individuals who have usually engaged in high-risk behaviors to reduce further harm from those behaviors. Now, one aspect of this is HIV prevention. As HIV shares risk factors with hepatitis C, anyone who has acquired hepatitis C recently may also be at risk, and therefore application of all the counseling messages as well as additional measures to reduce HIV transmission is critical. This is particularly highlighted by the outbreak of HIV recently detected amongst persons who are injecting drugs in Scott County, Indiana, where over 100 individuals were infected with HIV via unsafe needles. Knowledge of one's hepatitis C status is critical. It's important information given to the patient regarding their ability to transmit the virus to other people, as well as if they're negative, whether they are susceptible to acquisition of hepatitis C. All of this together may inform further behaviors, and identification during this stage allows the potential for interruption of transmission. One aspect that I'd like to highlight is that hepatitis C incidence is likely rising in our country. While we don't have time to go into many aspects of the epidemic at present, this slide shows figures of the increase in heroin use, which has reached epidemic levels and is at least 50% more compared to a decade ago. Also shown here are increases in heroin deaths. Now, this epidemic, as shown in the right-hand graphs, is interesting in that one sees a particular increase amongst young white persons compared to their Hispanic or Black counterparts. Now, with every heroin death, there is a large pool of individuals who are abusing not only heroin but other opioids, and therefore place themselves at risk for for hepatitis C. Not shown here is the other highest risk group for acute hepatitis C, which are HIV-positive men who have sex with men. In this case, sexual transmission may be driving an increased incidence in that population. Next, I'd like to define acute hepatitis C, and this area is a source of confusion, largely because the literature may vary in its definitions. We can all agree that the main goal of acute hepatitis C identification is to find patients within the first months, typically defined as the first 6 months. The reason is this phase is defined as the time period where, firstly, spontaneous clearance is most probable or possible, and next, the responsiveness to exogenous interferon was highest, meaning that compared to the chronic phase, one could cure patients much more easily with exogenous interferon during the acute phase. Now, one key aspect is that acute hepatitis C is often asymptomatic in the vast majority of cases, with only a fraction presenting with significant symptoms that bring patients to medical attention. Some may experience a flu-like syndrome or more milder viral syndrome that usually does not result in presentation. Shown in the bottom left is a typical course of someone who ends up spontaneously clearing the infection on their own. One notices that first, hepatitis C RNA is present before an ALT spike, so to speak, as well as before the appearance of hepatitis C-specific antibodies. This outcome of spontaneous clearance or clinical recovery is very favorable, and one sees that the antibody is positive and the RNA is negative beyond that point. This points out the seronegative window in which antibody testing is insufficient to diagnose acute hepatitis C infection. Next, studies have shown that approximately two-thirds of spontaneous clearers, persons who are able to control the virus on their own, this occurs largely in the first 6 months. And this outcome is associated with a variety of features, including female gender, young age, being immunocompetent at baseline, non-African American race, as well as a variety of genes. And we'll return to those genes in a later slide. Interestingly, symptomatology, or having greater symptoms, particularly jaundice, is associated with a greater likelihood of clearance. Another aspect I'd like to point out at this time is that once someone is hepatitis C antibody positive, one can no longer use that as part of the diagnosis for acute hepatitis C, since that may remain positive for long periods of time, if not indefinite. And therefore, hepatitis C RNA testing is required to diagnose reinfection in those with a prior history of spontaneous clearance. This slide demonstrates one of the interesting outcomes of hepatitis C spontaneous clearance. That outcome is associated with protection from reinfection. This study from Johns Hopkins followed injection drug users in Baltimore on a regular basis and had identified people during their first or primary infection, and then also followed persons who were reinfected with a different virus. Now, interestingly, during that reinfection, in the vast majority of cases, the hepatitis C peak viral load, as well as the duration of viremia, was substantially and significantly lower during that second infection. This slide indicates that secondary immunity to this virus is possible, meaning that there is hope, for instance, for generating immunity via, let's say, a vaccine that could produce a similar situation where one is more likely to clear and have shorter durations of viremia during a challenge. This protection may be more relevant if patients are infected with the same genotype or even subtype of the hepatitis C virus, whereas an infection with a new genotype may abrogate some of that protection due to the wide variability in the virus. This next slide exhibits a dynamic course of acute hepatitis C. This individual presented very acutely with extreme elevations in the ALT into the thousands. During this time, he happened to be jaundiced, and he had a very high hepatitis C RNA level, close to 60 million. At initial presentation, his hepatitis C antibody test was negative, But then just weeks later, it turns positive. This is known as seroconversion and is a key element of diagnosing acute hepatitis C infection. If you can catch this during the infection, it is a slam dunk diagnosis. However, shown on this slide are also the great dynamic changes that may occur in some of these values. Firstly, you can see that ALT, you may miss that spike if that patient presents just weeks later, and it may not be quite as elevated as the initial presentation. If the patient presents later, you can also see that the hepatitis C RNA may be even transiently negative. And so this is a very dynamic situation in which repeat testing may allow identification of acute hepatitis C. To exhibit this, we return to this case described before. Again, her hepatitis C testing, her antibodies already reactive, and her RNA is 3300. Now, that is a lower value than is typically seen in the chronic phase of infection. However, those ALT and AST are pretty typical for the chronic phase. However, upon repeat testing, what you see here is that her ALT rises and her RNA also fluctuates greater than one log. And you really rarely see that in the chronic phase of infection. And so this dynamic change in these values suggests that this patient is in that earliest phase when spontaneous clearance may be possible during the acute phase. The next slide will talk about the utility of IL-28B testing. So, as mentioned before, there are some genes that help define both spontaneous clearance to hepatitis C as well as interferon-induced clearance. Specifically, single nucleotide polymorphisms on chromosome 19 were found to be significantly associated with those outcomes. Now, rapidly, commercial labs were able to develop a test which is available, although not FDA approved. And using that test, you can define a favorable genotype in the individual. If they're homozygous for the C allele, one is twice as likely to clear. Some studies suggest that this genotype, this human genotype, not the viral genotype, correlates with jaundice. However, this is not a perfect predictor. There are persons with the CC genotype that will not clear, and there are patients with the unfavorable genotypes who will clear. So, at the moment, clinical utility of the IL-28B genetic test is likely less important at present, especially because treatment cure rates during the chronic phase are so high, and we no longer need to make immediate treatment decisions, as described later in the talk. So to summarize the diagnosis of acute hepatitis C, one first needs a high clinical suspicion, meaning that one needs to screen for the behaviors to suspect whether or not the patient has the risk for acute hepatitis C. Then one will look for supporting laboratory data. Again, seroconversion makes the diagnosis obvious. However, since seroconversion can happen within weeks, one may be already seropositive. One can also look for the fluctuating hepatitis C RNA levels. And even a value under 100,000, which is rarer in the chronic phase, may tip you off that, well, we should think about acute hepatitis C. Again, hepatitis C RNA is necessary for the seronegative window if the hepatitis C antibody is negative, as well as for reinfections. One aspect is in high-risk populations, let's say a HIV-positive MSM or man who has sex with other men, one should react pretty quickly to changes in liver function tests or in the ALT that are regularly checked in those individuals, as that patient may be in the process of becoming infectious for hepatitis C, and that could change behaviors and one can prevent further infections. So, a clinician needs to first screen for those high-risk behaviors. For persons who inject drugs, one should also particularly watch out for sharing of any paraphernalia. As described in the case where the woman was very careful with needles and syringes, she was not so careful with other aspects, such as cookers and cottons, involved in heroin use. For HIV-positive men who have sex with men, the other high-risk group, avoidance of bloody practices and exposure to semen may be important for prevention. So asking those questions would be also important for diagnosis. At the moment, yearly antibodies are recommended for these individuals. And at least one study done by an investigator who is currently at Boston University showed that this approach may be cost-effective. Let's move to the rationale for treatment of acute hepatitis C. One counseling point is that unlike hepatitis B or even A, which can result in fulminant hepatitis, hepatitis C really rarely ever does that. And so treatment is unlikely to prevent acute liver failure and death. Now, for HIV-positive individuals, there is more rationale to treat early on during the infection due to some cases of very rapid fibrosis that have been noted by some providers. Now, in the past, the rationale to treat early included cure rates that were much higher during the acute phase than the chronic phase for interferon-based therapies. However, at this time, there are no data to indicate that in the interferon-free era, that shorter courses are just as effective. So at the moment, the major rationale to treat acute hepatitis C is to reduce transmission. Now again, returning to the topic of the burden of disease, it turns out that new infections are occurring and potentially rising in many areas of our country. In the state of Massachusetts, where I practice, one can see the surveillance data collected by the state of between 2002 and 2009. And interestingly, one sees a shift. One notices first the baby boomers present in both graphs. Now one sees a bimodal distribution of persons who likely acquired the infection under the age of 30. There are over 2,000 cases annually. This is all linked to the opioid epidemic that is expanding in both this region as well as other parts of our country. If one thinks about how to reduce those numbers of incident infections, one can go back to the concept of the basic reproductive number, or R0. This is a composite of the number of contacts per time, the probability of transmission per contact with an infectious person, and the duration that the patient is infectious to others. It is very clear from thinking about hepatitis C that while one can work on reducing the number of contacts per unit and perhaps the probability of transmission by use of cleaner equipment, etc., it is really the duration, the lifelong duration of those who do not spontaneously clear the virus that is the major driver throughout a population. And sustaining an epidemic or an increase in prevalent cases, A, one is seeing rising opiate use. One is seeing in some areas of the country, such as Indiana, a lack of prevention services for persons who inject drugs. The fact that this is, in the vast majority of cases, asymptomatic and patients do not know their status and can be making decisions to spread this virus or to be place themselves at risk of this virus, one can see why this problem has grown. The other problem is that prevalent disease does not decrease very easily, largely because the earliest stages of disease are often not treated due to problems in accessing the novel therapies that do have very high cure rates. And given, again, that people do not die of this disease very early on, there's no very little fulminant acute hepatitis C, one can see why this is expanding. This slide demonstrates models based on data in three cities throughout the world, Edinburgh, Melbourne, and Vancouver, as to the number of patients who would need to be treated to reduce the prevalence of hepatitis C in high-risk populations, in this case, people who inject drugs. And one can see that one does not have to treat everybody to begin to achieve prevalence decreases. And these models do account for the commonly cited reinfection problem, that the rationale not to treat is that patients may just reinfect themselves. Another way to think about that is during the time that patients were treated and were clear of the virus, did they not infect other people? And therefore, linkage to services, including hepatitis C treatment, may be one important measure to decrease transmission. How to treat acute hepatitis C is now addressed in the following slides. Firstly, timing mattered greatly in the interferon era as described before, because if one waited, let's say in this case, more than 48 weeks, one starts to see a decrement of the effectiveness of interferon-based therapies, as demonstrated by this Italian study. One does see that persons with the IL-28B genotype did respond better overall beyond 48 weeks, but that the efficacy of treatments was not particularly different earlier on. However, this was not a randomized study, and so it inspired this large randomized control trial of hepatitis C therapy. It was interestingly designed in that those with asymptomatic hepatitis C, shown on the bottom lines, or group C, were immediately treated with pegylated interferon for 24 weeks. Whereas those with symptoms were given a chance to clear. As mentioned, symptoms do enhance the probability of clearance. And this may avoid overtreatment of individuals. And so group A was randomized to immediate treatment for symptomatic individuals, whereas group B were able to wait and see, so to speak. And so when examining these three approaches, these were the eventual outcomes. Now, for group A and group B, one can see that group B did the delayed therapy arm. One did avoid treatment in 11 of 52 patients. However, overall, in the intention to treat analysis, their outcomes were not very different. The immediate treatment groups did have higher treatment rates. However, when one looks at the actual completers of the treatment, one begins to see that this treatment was very effective. And therefore, it seems that the waiting period may have resulted in loss of patients who then did not get treated. Overall, this indicates that pegylated interferon therapies were highly dependent on whether patients adhered to the medications and completed treatment. This study mentions the use of pegylated interferon, ribavirin, and telaprevir for a total of 12 weeks. 41 patients were enrolled during this time frame, and there were some patients who spontaneously cleared and avoided treatment. Ultimately, 19 patients were treated. A lot of these patients did have the favorable genotype, interestingly, and an 84% cure rate, known as SVR12, or sustained virologic response, with a negative RNA at 12 weeks after therapy. Historically, this was improved from a cohort from the same individuals who treated with pegylated interferon ribavirin. However, we are in a new era of treatment. So what shall we do while awaiting data from interferon-free regimens? All published data are in the interferon era. One could go back to the shortened course pegylated interferon plus or minus ribavirin. However, many patients and providers do not like the side effects associated with that treatment and would therefore not proceed. In most cases, it is very reasonable to wait for spontaneous clearance unless the risk of transmission is high. One could argue this, for instance, for a surgeon who was acutely infected with hepatitis C after needle stick injury. In order to return to work, that surgeon may need clearance sooner rather than later. And as mentioned before, it would be interesting to apply in a group of individuals who are at extremely high risk for further transmission, such as active people who inject drugs. After this waiting period, one can treat with the same regimens used for chronic infection. We do not expect the high efficacy rates described in other talks on this website to be lower during acute infection. And during this time frame, it is a unique opportunity to provide the knowledge, services, and treatment to reduce further transmission. This slide reviews some of the guidelines or the guidance provided by the AASLD and the IDSA for the testing, managing, and treatment of hepatitis C virus. One is to vaccinate and to ensure immunity against other hepatitis viruses and provide that important education to avoid further transmission. For whom to treat, in that section, there is an important table showing the groups of persons who may be at elevated risk for hepatitis C transmission, and therefore benefits may be realized beyond just cure of that one individual. Now, one can consider the decision to initiate treatment earlier, again, preventing transmission, for instance, a needle stick injury to the surgeon, as described on the prior slide, that individual may need to return to work sooner and therefore should receive therapy. One can also consider IL-28B testing, although overall, it is unlikely this will play a major role. Laboratory monitoring during the setting of acute hepatitis C is recommended, firstly, to provide information for spontaneous clearance versus the outcome of persistent infection, and to avoid additional hepatotoxic insults, particularly when the ALT is markedly elevated, to avoid excess acetaminophen and alcohol consumption, and also to reduce the risk of transmission. For those who have substance use disorders, referral to specialists is recommended. Again, if patients have and the practitioner have decided that a delay in treatment is acceptable, monitoring for spontaneous clearance is recommended. Owing to high efficacy and safety, the same regimens that are recommended for chronic hepatitis C infection are recommended for acute infection. These are due to the extremely high rates of cure for these novel regimens in the chronic phase, and it is not expected that the acute phase would have a lower rate. Again, the vast majority of data, though, are with pegylated interferon, which is less costly, but does have far more side effects. Currently, experts in the United States would not recommend this option. Acute hepatitis C incidence is rising in the United States, and achievement of viral clearance, whether spontaneous or through treatment, will be important to prevent further cases. Diagnosis requires a high clinical suspicion. At a minimum, yearly antibody is recommended. And if one seroconverts, one should strongly consider whether that patient is in that acute phase. And the two highest risk groups, as mentioned, are people who inject drugs and HIV-positive MSM. Acute hepatitis C is a very dynamic phase of the infection. The ALTs may be quite elevated, much more so than in the chronic phase, as well as fluctuating viral titers. Spontaneous clearance occurs during this phase and not in the chronic phase, usually within the first 6 months. And determining this outcome of whether a patient clears or not informs the patient's infectiousness to others. IL-28B genotyping is available for prognosing, however, is currently less useful for clinical decision making. Maintain that high clinical suspicion because there are problems with each of the clinical tests. The antibody, you might have patients, for instance, in that seronegative window. So one needs to put together the diagnosis based on the prior probability or their history, as well as the supporting laboratory tests. Additional counseling points for newly identified acute hepatitis C is that patients will not likely have fulminant disease or die of their acute infection. Possibility of spontaneous clearance should be communicated to the individual, and one can then also counsel for viremic individuals that they are able to transmit to others. Treatment decisions. Most often, we will be allowing for spontaneous clearance for those identified during the acute phase. There is no reason to believe that SVRs will be lower for the same regimens used for chronic hepatitis C. At the moment, as of summer 2015, we are awaiting data of various clinical trials in progress of interferon-free regimens, which will inform the future treatment of acute hepatitis C. This has been the IAS USA module on acute hepatitis C infection. I am Dr. Arthur Kim. Thank you for listening.